Good afternoon, good morning to everyone. Welcome to this new event of the Middle East Institute in Singapore. It's a great pleasure for us to have with us this afternoon Dr. Hisham Hellier, who's a good friend of the Institute, who has been coming here a few times already. We have a title for this webinar and seminar, I should say. This is a hybrid format. We have people in the auditorium here, as well as online. The title, I must say, is maybe one of the coolest title for a seminar on the Middle East. The more things change, the more they stay the same. I say that I think it's you, Hisham, that chose the title. So you have copyright on this one. let me say a few words on our speaker before I explain the format of this discussion. Dr. Hellier is a British scholar of geopolitics, security studies that has been working and writing on those topics for more than the past 20 years. He's currently a senior associate fellow in international security studies at the Royal United Services Institute in Defense and Security in London, Russia. He holds also another affiliation as a scholar for the Carnegie Institute Endowment for International Peace based in Washington. He was appointed deputy convener for the Home Office Task Force on Tackling Radicalization within the Counterterrorism Team by the UK government. Let me add that he wrote several books as well, in particular one published by Hearst in 2019 on the Egyptian Revolution and the fallouts after the end of the revolution itself. Dr. Hellier, it's a great pleasure again to have you with us. Before I start with my first questions, let me turn to the audience, both in the room and online, to say that this is a conversation. The idea is to make it as lively as possible. So Dr. Hellier actually just came back from the region. He was traveling to Jordan, to Egypt and Turkey in the recent weeks. So it's also very useful for us to have him giving us his takeaways, his impressions from the region. So as I said, it's a conversation. If you'd like to ask a question for those who are in the room with us, we have the microphone, so just raise your hand and we can give you the floor. For those of you on Zoom, please write your question in the chat box, and then we'll make sure to raise and to explain the question here in the room. But let me use the privilege of being the moderator to ask maybe the first question, and which is probably the biggest question that everyone is wondering about the Middle East in the past days. As I said at the beginning, almost as a joke, the title is a good one. The more things change, the more they stay the same. This is a title that was decided for this seminar a few weeks ago. And a lot of the people probably wonder after the latest wave of Iranian strikes, drone strikes, cruise missiles, and the ballistic missiles on Israel, which came as retaliation after the Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria. Do you feel, Dr. Hellier, that yes, things are still the same, the title is still relevant, or actually we may be seeing something that is like a game changer, the fact that we've never seen Iran targeting the Israeli territory? So big question. Probably we could spend a lot of time on this, but I think it's a perfect way to let you give us your views on what's going on right now.
Jean-Luc, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back in Singapore. It's a pleasure to be back at MEI. Thank you to MEI, to Carl, and to your whole team for kindly setting this up. It's nice to be back amongst friends. And I'm very pleased to see Minister Zain al-Abidine Rashid, my old friend, here with us today. And of course, all of you in the audience online. And I will reiterate what Jean-Luc said. We were talking before this session began. And the whole point behind this format was to give us all opportunity to have this as a discussion. I'm not intending on giving you a grand lecture where nobody gets to ask any questions or make any comments, asking me to sort of illustrate my thoughts. No, I would like very much from the get-go, from the outset, that especially those of you online, please take advantage of the chat, send through any questions that you might have, questions that don't necessarily have to be aimed at stuff that I've said, but at the situation more generally, and then you'll give us more things to address over the course of the next hour or whatever it is. So please, very seriously, do take advantage of that. I will answer Jean-Luc's question, and then we hope to address any questions that either those of you in the room or especially online may have. So in terms of, you know, have things changed? You know, and I think that for those of us who have been watching the broader Arab world, Middle East region, for our careers, the number of times that we've heard that, oh, things have changed. You know, there's some brand new crisis that's underway that will redefine the region. I remember this same sort of expression almost yearly, with one exception. The Israelis insisted that everything was fine and nothing was going to change. And then, boom, October 7th happened. And the assumptions that went into the whole, oh, nothing's going to change because everything's fine, were blown out of the water. Jake Sullivan, who's in the Biden administration and a senior member of Biden's team, famously wrote this piece in Foreign Affairs that was published last year, where it was, you know, it was all about how, no, the Middle East has never been quieter, you know, and everything is stable, nothing's moving. And it's famous because the online version of the piece looks very different than the printed version of the piece because October 7th. So the results of the last, you know, few days, I think are still panning out. I think that, yes, Iran moved the needle in a certain way because it struck Israeli territory directly from Iran, as opposed to proxies or you know, groups that it otherwise influences, which is an expression I prefer over proxies. But are we going to see, you know, a massive escalation from this point? I frankly don't know. And I think that, you know, it's not a common phrase in our profession to say, I don't know. Analysts are not very fond of saying, you know, I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen next. And people make all sorts of wild and crazy predictions. But I think it's foolhardy to assume that we do know what's going to happen. But what we do know is what the factors are in defining the next outcome. And that next outcome has everything to do with what Israel decides going forward. And the factors, there are two major factors that I think are weighing in that regard most heavily. The first is what Benjamin Netanyahu thinks is going to serve his political interests within Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu is nothing if not a cynical, opportunistic politician, being polite. And I think it's very clear that that's overriding, frankly, his political calculus over the past 6 months. So that's number one. Number two is what Netanyahu assesses is going to be the American response to any action that he takes going forward. And I say assesses, I don't say what Biden has told him or hasn't told him. I'm sure the Biden administration has told him already multiple times that they will not back an offensive war against Iran. But I'm not sure that Netanyahu will actually believe them. And I'm not sure that they will assume that in the event of a war, that the Americans won't eventually come in on side anyway. So I think that a major calculation going on right now is in between the point that hostilities break out and the point where the Americans come full in support of Israel in any such conflict. What's going to happen in between? Is that a risk that they're willing to take? You know, there'll be those sorts of things. But I don't think that they're going to believe that the Americans won't come in fully in support of Israeli defense, but also I suspect the Israeli offense. I think that that's something that they will be counting on. And frankly, they would be wrong not to count on it based on how the Biden administration has behaved with regards to Netanyahu and Israel over the past 6 months, which I think has been very reckless. I think it's actually been very dangerous because it encourages a sense of impunity. We've seen the situation in Gaza go from bad to worse, to worse, to worse, to worse, in a horrific way over the past 6 months. And that is fundamentally down to what Netanyahu has correctly ascertained would be the American response, which is to say very little, at least in terms of leverage that the United States could use. That's also something that doesn't change, right? In terms of going back to the title of our talk, some things don't change. And we also back, so nothing that you know stays the same. We're back to that mantra about, oh, we need a two-state solution. You know, that's what it's going to solve everything. That's a nice idea, but it's also an idea that the Israelis have effectively vetoed, not for the past you know few months, but for the past few decades. And we're not going to see a change in that regard either. And I don't think that we would ever see a change without a change from within the United States, because I think that it would require the intervention of a very strong American president to say, no, this is what's got to happen unless you want to threaten the relationship that you have with us in terms of arms and other leverage. And this is a fundamental point that I think is actually going to force us a type of change, but it might not be a good one, which I don't think people are really aware of. We make a big deal, at least in analytical circles, about Netanyahu's awful, Netanyahu's got to go, Bibi's the problem, we could just get rid of him, you know, things would be much better. And I don't think that's true. I think fundamentally that rests on very flawed assumptions about what Israel is and what Israel isn't, what Israel society is developing into, what the Israeli political spectrum is developing into. And I think if people want to be really serious and honest about this, then they should assume that people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are the far-right members of Netanyahu's cabinet, are the faces of the future. They're not marginal. They're already mainstream. I mean, we've established that they're already mainstream. They've been mainstream for quite some years. But as we go forward, they become more and more the face of the center. That's the trend of Israeli politics and has been for the past, you know, 10, 20 years, as in that trend happening. And I don't think that's going to change. I think that that is going to continue to be the trend, which means that's the type of Israel that Israeli political leadership that we're going to have to deal with. And if we admit that, then I think we begin to get to a point where we think, okay, if that's who we're dealing with, then what are the steps that we have to take outside in order to find the solution that increases stability, doesn't lead to more instability, de-escalates conflict, doesn't increase it or escalate it. But if we don't, if we continue to hold on to this, you know, fantastical idea of, no, it's generally, you know, quite a liberal outlook, a political spectrum that, you know, they just need to get rid of, you know, this bad apple. It's not a bad apple, you know. I mean, Netanyahu is quite unique in many ways, but most of his policies, at least with regards to the Palestinians, they are quite widely popular in Israel. You know, all of these protests that we've seen in Israel over the past 6 months, they're about the hostages. They're not about a ceasefire. They're about the hostages. If there were no hostages in play, there is very little appetite in Israeli society to stop the bombardment of the Palestinians in Gaza, even if it went to 100,000. Okay. When it comes to a two-state solution, there's a very, I mean, it's now less than majority. I think it's 30% in the last point, maybe 35. Dalia Schleinden has done some good work on this. The level of support for escalation, the support for escalation against Hezbollah and going to war against Hezbollah, again, it's not, you know, some crazy right-wing view. No, there's quite a lot of support for this. The discourse that we've seen over the past 6 months that really fundamentally dehumanizes Palestinians, that came from the very top of the Israeli political spectrum right down to the bottom of it. Whether it was the prime minister, whether it was the president, senior members, senior ministers in the cabinet, you know, this is extremely widespread. So what do we do as the international community? How do we engage with a political elite and a political spectrum that is like that, and at the same time try to find models that will allow for a two-state solution or the ending of a conflict or? And right now, I don't think we've learned that lesson. I think the Biden administration has made it very clear over the past 6 months that, you know, rhetoric isn't going to work. Rhetoric does not teach the lesson. There's got to be the use of actual leverage, which, by the way, the United States has done before with regards to Israel, most famously under Reagan, but who was a Republican president, by the way, but also in other conflicts and in other theaters. It's obviously more complicated when it comes to Israel because of American politics, but I think that people need to get to that sort of point of realizing that if you really do want things to change and not stay the same, that's something that you have to do. I'll say one last thing before I turn over to any questions from here in the room, but especially online, which is that there's a massive price for what's going on right now. There's a massive price, of course, first and foremost, in terms of the death toll in Gaza and the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. And that, of course, is the first on the list of prices. There's another price that relates to regional security and all of those things that I think everybody would be keenly aware of. But there's one more price that that I should think concerns people in Singapore. And that's what this says about the nature of our world order. Singapore is a small country. Singapore depends quite rightly, or rather should quite rightly, depends on a rules-based order where international law is paramount, where it doesn't matter if you're a small state or a big state, that certain things still apply irrespectively. And the last 6 months have been incredibly damaging to the notion of a rules-based order. When the UN Security Council issues a resolution and the response of the Biden White House is to say, it's non-binding. This is incredible. You know, it's not a PR statement. It is a very clear declaration with regards to the nature of the rules-based order, which means that it's not actually rules-based. When the ICJ is investigating a state for plausible, as the ICJ said, plausible a plausible case of genocide, and the most powerful country in the world, the United States, says we see no evidence for this claim, it's baseless. You know, you don't need to agree with the claim, but to say that it's baseless and to dismiss the case, which the ICJ has already said is a plausible claim. That's the highest court in the international community. What does that say about respect for a rules-based order? And it says a lot, and none of it's good. And I'm really fundamentally very concerned about that, because this will not be the last crisis that we face in the Middle East, nor internationally. You know, we've already seen, of course, the invasion of Ukraine. We are likely to see many other things take place in our lifetimes, not least because of the climate crisis. We need a rules-based order. Fundamentally, we are in desperate need of such an order in order to avert catastrophe and minimize damage. And when we take this sort of approach, unfortunately, the way that the United States has done over the past 6 months, we threaten that. And we threaten that to our own detriment with prices that I don't think we can imagine yet. So on that very cheery note, I'll let people, you know, ask whatever questions they want.
Thank you very much, Hisham, for this great tour d'horizon. We'll Let me turn to our participants, both in the room and online. Again, just as a reminder, if you'd like to ask questions, you can write them in the chat box. Let me ask you the first question from Mohammed, who's joining us online. What was Hamas' aim with the October 7 attack, and how is this attack different from previous attacks? Did they anticipate, predict the Israeli response? So a very light question to start with. Over to you.
So it's a good question. It's one that has been raised many, many times in the past 6 months. I'm not dismissing the question. As I said, I think it's a very good question, but it's been raised many times because different parts to the answer begin to become more apparent as time goes on. But of course, you're also answering the question against the fog of war, right? In that Hamas has a vested interest in saying that it knew about this or it knew about that, or, you know, in different parts of it saying we knew, we didn't know. So there's a lot of disinformation, I feel, that's involved in trying to piece together what's going on in the actual answer. But what the best I've been able to ascertain as of yet, and maybe this will change, okay? But the best that I've been able to ascertain is that first, there was a small, and I'll give you these details because I think it does have an impact on how we understand what the point, okay, of this horrific attack actually was. First, it was a small group within Hamas that knew about it, or at least knew the details. I think there was a larger group that knew that something was going to happen, but didn't have the details of anything, just simply knew that something was going to happen. But that was the case even within Hamas itself, let alone outside of Hamas more generally, including, by the way, Iran. You know, all of the intelligence reports that I've seen with regards to Iranian involvement is that they did not know what was going to happen October 7th. They might have had a warning that there might be some sort of escalation, but I don't think more than that. And they certainly weren't responsible. Now, of course, there were warnings, okay? But those were found out anyway, right? I mean, there was one report about the Egyptians knowing that something was happening. There was chatter, but that they actually told the Israelis. I saw that report. But even within Israel itself, it wasn't that Israel was not aware that something was coming October 7th. Israel was aware, but didn't believe it. Okay, so it's not, again, the conspiracy theories about, oh, they knew and let it happen so they could do that. This is, in my opinion, complete nonsense. But I think that what you had was a rejection of intelligence, even though they had the intelligence. Okay, anyway, put that to one side. Small group. I think that Hamas goes in. First, the force that goes in on October 7th isn't exclusively Hamas. The leadership is Hamas. The largest proportion of the fighters is definitely Hamas. But then they also opened up in the morning itself to other smaller militant groups, including Islamic Jihad, but also other smaller groups in Gaza, to join them on the offensive. And then later on in the day, because the border cross, the fence was utterly broken, lots of people just crossed, including like criminal gangs and just random people. Okay, so that definitely also happened. Now, when it comes to what they foresaw or did not foresee, and this is why I bring in all these details, the best that I can tell so far, and again, this might change going forward, but the best I can tell so far is that Hamas went in. Hamas intended to strike certain targets. I personally think that they did intend to strike civilian targets. I don't think it was in the fog of war that happened. I think actually know that they there's evidence to suggest that at the very least. And Human Rights Watch should hopefully be publishing a report, I think, in the next month or so, where they've tried to uncover quite what war crimes were committed by Hamas on October 7th. And I will be very interested in that report. I think that they will do they usually do quite a good job on these sorts of things. It's taken them a really long time. They haven't rushed it. So by that point, it would be 7-8 months afterwards. And I think that they will get a lot of this stuff cleared up. That they did obviously target military and armed armed officers as well. But I think but this is where the answer to your question becomes, you know, pertinent. And I think that what they probably thought they were going to be able to do was, let's say, get this far into Israeli territory, take this number of hostages, probably, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, you know, something like that, and probably kill that many people. And as a result of these different things, expect a reprisal of this. Well, I think what happened is that they got in, and because of a complete failure on the side of Israeli intelligence, because of a redeployment of Israeli military and defensive forces to the West Bank and elsewhere within Israel as well, because of a failure of their defense lines, you know, I mean, multiple failures, and, you know, this is what the Israelis say themselves, they didn't get this far, they got this far. And they just kept on going until they, I mean, to the point where, when I say that they just kept on going, the IDF, I think, admitted that they were still mopping up 4 days later, that there were still armed gunmen from Gaza in Israel proper 4 days later. If they had planned to do this, but actually they ended up going this far, then any assessment that they made that the reprisal will be here would have gone out the window anyway. Okay, so I don't think that they meant to get here. I think that they thought that they could get no further than this, and that they were happy to get no further than this. But then once they tried, they realized that it was, you know, for lack of a better expression, a house of cards, and they managed to just roll right in and do a lot more damage. I don't think they ever thought that they were going to kill 1,200 people. I don't think they regret it, by the way. Don't let anyone misunderstand. I don't think they regret this in the slightest. But their calculations for reprisal were based on a certain set of numbers, and they exceeded those numbers, I think, quite dramatically. And I don't think they expected to, but that they did. And as a result, they were never prepared for any such reprisal that they were going to get. They were prepared for a reprisal of this amount on the basis of getting that far. Once you cross that, there's no way they were prepared for this. And by the way, nobody could be. There's no way to prepare for a reprisal of this type against Gaza. Okay, this is overwhelming force against a population that doesn't have the ability to defend itself against this sort of strike and this type of bombardment. So any plan, because your questioner asked, you know, what were they planning? To some extent, it doesn't matter what they were planning, because nobody could defend, nobody could plan to defend against a reprisal of this magnitude. And I don't think that they were insane. I think that they planned for this amount of reprisal based on going this far in. And when their attack far exceeded that, they were utterly unprepared for what was going to happen next. There were some reasons that have been stated about why they decided to make this attack in the first place. One was the thing that I've heard many times was that they wanted to make sure that the Palestinian issue was put back on the agenda, that they felt that regional developments were going in a direction that meant that people would forget about it. And this in particular about the Saudi-Israel deal. That might have been part of it. I don't know if it was the main part of it. That there was also a desire that had grown over time to capture the leadership of the Palestinian cause, which remains with the PLO, which remains with Fatah, which remains with the PA, you know, irrespective of how people feel about the PA in the territories. The fact is that internationally, it's the PA that controls what the Palestinian narrative is in terms of political representation. Any country that's recognized Palestine as a state, those embassies or representatives, those are PA. They're not Hamas. So I think that that was part of it. And also, I mean, just make this really clear, hostilities did not begin on October 7th. You know, Hamas, as far as I'm concerned, is a terrorist organization that carried out an atrocity on October 7th. There were attacks against civilians by the Israeli state, by settlers on the West Bank, not for weeks, not for months, but for years before October 7th happened. And actually, the death toll on the West Bank in 2023, before October 7th happened, was incredibly high. And this was the result of increased activity by settlers, backed completely by the Israeli state, against an occupied population. So there are lots of grievances, and the grievances are legitimate. Okay, of course, the response is completely legitimate, but the grievances are totally legitimate. So I don't think that we can be surprised that something happened. We can be surprised at what happened. We can be horrified by it. I think that we should be, but I don't think we can be surprised that it did.
Let me ask you another question, this time from Georgi Bustin, our former colleague that you know quite well. And the question goes back to Iran and the place of the Gulf states. You just mentioned the speculations on the Israeli-Saudi normalization and how this could have played out as an element of trigger for Hamas. Question from Georgi is there a danger of Iran using the Gulf as, I quote, whipping boy for Israel?
Well, the Gulf states certainly feel so. And the Gulf states are, I think, particularly the UAE, but also the Saudis, I think, are very concerned about the prospect of being targeted by the Iranians under the pretext or assumption or reality that they are standing for Israeli interests. And the Saudis and the Emiratis have made it very clear, we don't want hostilities with Iran. We are not going to, in fact, I think they made it very clear to the Americans, you will not strike Iran from any bases that are on our territory, because that puts us at risk. Okay. And they made this really clear. And it was interesting to see, you know, at one point, the language and the rhetoric with regards to Iran coming from quite a number of Gulf states, the UAE and Saudi in particular, was actually incredibly harsh and tense. And by the way, not without, you know, any just cause. There are lots of good reasons for that. But the rhetoric and the discourse was becoming very, very fiery. And at some point, it became very clear, I think, to the leaderships in both of those countries that this is actually not a great idea. Because if the point is to calibrate tension at a particular level, we don't know where it's going to end. You know, we can't necessarily control how hot or how aggressive or how intense this is going to end at. And once you, it's sort of like pushing a ball down the road, right? You might think, okay, if I kick it just a little bit, it'll get to that point. But who said that it's just going to get to that point? Okay, what if something happens on the wave? There's like a gust of wind, okay? Mm-hmm. And then it goes past that point. It's like, yeah, but I only kicked it that much. It's like, who cares how you kicked it? There are other factors, other variables you can't account for, okay? So actually the rhetoric has diminished tremendously. It's become far more about, you know, we want a detente. The Saudis have tried to come to a new arrangement with the Iranians. Actually, if I remember correctly, I think the Emiratis were involved in this as well. But before the Iranians threw the missiles at Israel a few days ago, there was a multilateral Arab effort to try to get the Iranians not to respond or not to retaliate in a certain way. Okay. And I think actually the intention in that regard is quite genuine. They are looking for a way to de-escalate. They don't want there to be, irrespective of how they, you know, do or do not support the Iranian regime in places like Syria or Lebanon or whatever, or indeed just the very nature of the Iranian regime in terms of the Khamenei model, but that's, I won't say that's irrelevant, but what's important to them is finding a way to de-escalate. So yes, I think that they're, I think that at least the Gulf states are very concerned that indeed Iran will use them in that way, as Jordi asked.
Let me turn now to questions from Khada Soliman. Questions that relate to both the role of Arab countries and the prospects on the Rafah offensive. So first, how would you assess the ongoing efforts made by Arab countries, in particular Qatar and Egypt? So I assume with regards to the prospects of a ceasefire in Gaza. The other question, which is in a way related, is what about the expected Rafah ground attack? Do you see it happening soon, as it was claimed by Netanyahu himself? What will be the implications of that offensive if it happens on Egypt and the region? So we still are on very light questions for you this afternoon.
Following the Iranian strike, I think that the, let me rewind a second. Within Washington, D.C., London, and a number of European capitals, the pressure from within political elites, not necessarily the governments of those countries, but within at least political elites over the past, especially month or two, has been increasing with regards to not only a ceasefire, but the suspension of or restricting of military assistance and sale of arms in the UK, and as I said, in parts of Europe, but also louder voices emerging when it came to the United States. And as a result of this, I was more optimistic that there could be a way to avoid or at least delay much more a Rafah offensive. I think that that equation is now being changed, that the Israelis will use the Iranian attack as a way to blunt any criticism of how the bombardment of Gaza is continuing. And I think it'll be difficult for that discussion to continue in the same way in those capitals as a result. I think that there's no lack of political will in the Israeli establishment to invade Rafah. And the question is about when and how, not if. And the how is going to be dependent on what sort of pressure and leverage, if any, is going to be used by the Biden administration with regards to the Israelis. I don't know how much that is going to delay the operation. I hope it will fundamentally change how the operation goes forward, because if they try to do to Rafah what they did to Khan Yunis or Gaza City, we're talking about a mass casualty event as a pretty much definitive eventuality. That's a polite way of calling it a massacre. And we've already seen multiple massacres in Gaza. And that, I think, would, first, it would be horrific. It would be a violation of international law. It would be repugnant on many levels, but it would also be incredibly destabilizing. And I think in that situation, one scenario which has been posited, you know, quite a lot over the past 6 months is that Palestinians in Gaza would cross the border into the Sinai. Now, this is not a favored, to say the least, option for the Egyptians for multiple reasons. I don't know how that's going to be avoided if an attack of this nature takes place. And I don't know what Egypt would do in that regard, you know. It's a very, very difficult question there, because I don't think people, well, maybe people in Singapore understand this. I'm not sure that people in many Western capitals do. one of the major reasons that Egypt is so reluctant to open the border and just allow people to cross is that they don't want to be complicit in ethnic cleansing. And they have very good reasons for thinking that's exactly what it would be, because there is no example in history of Palestinians being forced to leave their homes in Palestine, anywhere in Palestine, and being allowed to come back. It has always been the case that they have been forced to leave and they have been refused re-entry, especially as you see the discourse coming from the political elite in Israel. It's very clear that they have no intention of letting these people ever come back. So this is a really big concern for the Egyptians, even against the backdrop of a huge humanitarian catastrophe. There was another part to that question. What have I missed?
Qatar's role.
Oh, and in terms of the ceasefire?
Yes.
So I think, frankly, the Qataris and the Egyptians have been doing the best they can do. When it comes to the negotiations, I think that they've been trying very hard. The fact of the matter is that on multiple occasions, the Israelis have been very kind of, you know, in, out in terms of the negotiations. And it's not really much of a negotiation for a ceasefire, okay? This isn't a negotiation for a ceasefire. This is a negotiation for a pause in hostilities, with constantly the repeated and very public declaration that once this period elapses, we will go back to bombing you. Okay, so it's not a really good way to go into a discussion about negotiations, right? The Israelis are making it very, very clear, we are going to stop bombing you so you can give us our people, and we will give you 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and then we're going to bomb you again. You know, I mean, it's not exactly a great way to move forward. But that, and they've made it very clear, that's what we're talking about here. You understand that, right? And I think the hope in places like, you know, DC or elsewhere is that, well, we'll start with 3 weeks and then things will change and develop. And, you know, I mean, if it's the best that they can do, then that's the best that they can do. But, you know, the Egyptians and the Qataris don't have tremendous amounts of cards here. They don't have leverage over Hamas and they don't have leverage over the Israelis. The ones who have leverage over the Israelis, and the Israelis are the fundamental partner here, is the United States. You know, Hamas, who has leverage over Hamas? Who has leverage over Hamas? You know, they have contacts, they have networks, but nobody has the same sort of leverage over Hamas that the United States has over Israel. And there's one final thing that I want to say here about that particular point. When we talk about ceasefire, there is this constant refrain that I hear in different parts of the West that, but Hamas has to do ABC. It's like, Hamas has to do ABC. You know, that's, I don't question them the slightest. I think that all the hostages should be released, but you are holding hostage the entirety of Gaza to force Hamas to do ABC. That's collective punishment that is bringing Gaza into a state of famine and starvation. It's fundamentally wrong. And I don't think that we can, I don't think we should normalize that as an acceptable political position.
Thank you. Let me go to, I have a few questions on the list. One from Shakti in the back. Would you like to ask it directly? You can do it. I mean, okay. Well, in this case, I'll read it, and if necessary, you can correct me. This relates to the Saudis' reported role in intercepting, or at least playing a role.
Saudis.
Saudi Arabia playing a role in the interception of Iranian missiles or drones on Israel. Reported role. We don't know, I think, any detail.
Actually, they denied it completely.
Yes, and that's what Shakti says, despite their public denial. But would you say it is not likely that the Saudis played any role? Or if we assume they did, would you say, what do you think this could have in terms of impact on the Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. So the question is, if we assume that the Saudis did play that role, could that actually weaken, damage their own prospects of lowering the tensions with Iran?
It could, but I'm not sure that it's true, to be honest with you. At the moment, all that we have on that is that the Saudis said, no, we didn't do anything. And I think it works very much in their interests to have actually not done anything. Now, the alternative scenario is that they did do something because it flew through Saudi territory. But it's not necessary for those missiles to go through Saudi territory. They could have gone through Iraq. They don't need to have gone through Saudi. I don't think Saudi would have wanted to be in the position of having to shoot them down. And I don't know if the Iranians would have necessarily wanted to put the Saudis in that position either, because as you mentioned, they have this developing relationship between Riyadh and Tehran. Now, if they did shoot through, then I don't know how much of damage it would do to that relationship, because I think they would have known that the Saudis would have to, from their perspective, shoot them down, because it would be using Saudi territory for an attack on the Israelis, and then that could make Saudi a target for Israeli reprisals as well, right? I mean, that's how I think the Saudis would look at it, and I think the Iranians would see their point even if they disagreed. So I suspect that the detente will develop in a positive fashion between the Israelis and the Saudis. Sorry, between the Iranians and the Saudis. I actually don't think it will develop in a positive fashion with regards to the Israelis and the Saudis until something quite significant takes place with regard to the Palestinians.
Let me go back to the Palestinians with a question which relates to international law. And it's a bit technical always when we talk about law, and a very sensitive topic, because you mentioned the case at the ICJ level regarding the potential for genocide. The question comes from Arun, who's asking about if Israel can reject the ICJ's ruling, what other agencies could question Israel? I assume the question relates to the decision that related to the precautionary measures that Israel has to implement because of the risk of genocide. So the question, again, in terms of international law, if we didn't see any change since then on the ground, what are the other agencies that could do something? What is the options in terms of international law?
So international law is unfortunately a nice idea, but it doesn't have the mechanisms for enforcement without states deciding to implement. And, you know, this is one of the things that I alluded to at the beginning. When we talk about a rules-based approach, a rules-based world order, you have to be willing to uphold those rules. And if you don't, or if you claim those rules don't exist, or if you claim that actually, there was another one. A reporter asked, was it Matt Miller? Yeah, Matthew Miller, who's another spokesperson for the Biden administration, do the Geneva Conventions apply in Gaza? And he refused to answer. The fact that he would not confirm that the Geneva Conventions apply in the occupied territories is extraordinary, right? What does that tell everybody? It tells everybody that those conventions aren't actually conventions at all. That they're literally that, they're conventionary. They're not actually law. They're not things that you have to take too seriously. They're advisory opinions. You know, they're kind of like guidelines. I think this creates huge damage for us. I think it creates huge damage when we have these institutions, whether it's the ICJ, whether it's the ICC, okay? The International Criminal Court, or UN Security Council resolutions. I mean, there are scores of Security Council resolutions that have been ignored by the Israelis for decades, including 242 in particular, which is about the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the occupied territories. To date, they withdrew from Sinai, they annexed the Golan Heights, they actually annexed East Jerusalem, and they've effectively annexed parts of the West Bank already, and they remain in occupation of all of these territories. What are the options? The options are indeed for states to take these things seriously and to penalize those that contravene international law when they do so. We have shown that, at least with regards to the West and Ukraine, that we will take measures in certain ways when it comes to violations of international law by our enemies, and where it does not hurt our friends. That's not international law. That's not rules-based. That's making it a hobby. And we frankly, again, we enter into a very dangerous world where the law of the jungle applies.
Thank you for this reference to Thomas Hobbes, I guess, which is always good in an academic environment, but true, on the importance, but also the struggle for international law and rules-based order. Let me turn to the audience if we have other questions or comments. We have a few minutes left. Do we have questions on the Zoom? And let me ask a question regarding we discussed the let's say the changes and the things that did not change. And you mentioned Jake Sullivan's speech or article a few days before the war. What do you think about all the prospects that existed before October 7 regarding the Israel-Gulf rapprochement, the India-Middle East-Europe corridor, all those talks about, let's say, the rapprochement and the new Middle East, as Benjamin Netanyahu himself called it, the General Assembly of the UN a month before. Do you think this is gone? Do you think that...
I think it's in deep freeze. I don't think it's gone, but I do think it's in deep freeze. Let's forget about October 7th just for the moment and go back to October 6th. Okay, October 6th, the Saudi-Israeli deal was like a three-pronged lock, okay? And each one of those locks had to be opened at the same time in a particular way in order for the door to open. You need to get it through the Israeli political establishment, which was very difficult to imagine given the inclusion of people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich in the cabinet, who would balk at any suggestion of even a symbolic compromise with the Palestinians. And that was necessary for the Saudis. So there's got to be something. There's got to be something. That was lock number one. Lock number two was with regards to the Saudis and the Americans. The Saudis wanted security guarantees, and they also wanted the ability for nuclear energy, right? So that's lock number two. Also very difficult because Congress was not going to be a walk in the park when it came to security guarantees with the Saudis. On the contrary, there were actually very loud voices saying, no, we're not interested in this, okay? Another lock in that regard related to how you're going to get it with the inclusion of the Palestinians in a particular way, which again was going to be very difficult. Getting all of these things right at the same time, I think, was always going to be extremely challenging. And the Saudis weren't in a rush, you know. I mean, I think the United States was in a rush. Okay, this was another lock, actually, that in order for this to happen, it had to happen really quickly. The idea being that if you try to do this after 2023, that in 2024, it's an election year, there won't be enough bandwidth from within the American establishment really push this forward, yada, yada, yada. And to get all three things in at once was going to be very difficult. Post October 7th, the Saudi position becomes much harder. The Saudi position has essentially reverted back to the Arab Peace Initiative in terms of, no, there must be a Palestinian state, or at least a very definitive pathway. Okay, but you know, we're not doing this without like real movement when it comes to this. There is no suggestion that the Israelis are willing to do anything progressive in support of a compromise with the Palestinians at all. So that's very much out of the window. And the Americans, they keep on harping on about this, frankly. And you still see members of the administration talking about how important it is that, you know, we get this this historic deal across and so on. Yes, all of that's true as far as they're concerned from their perspective, but you are fundamentally misreading the room. Okay, the Israelis are completely clear. They have no desire to compromise with the Palestinians in any shape or form. If you want that to happen, you're going to have to use leverage that so far you've not been willing to use at all. And without movement on the Palestinian file, you will not get a deal with the Saudis. End off. And the Saudis are not in a rush. The Saudis are not in a rush. On the contrary, they know that if they hold out, they only stand to gain. And if they rush, they only stand to lose.
Let me turn to, I have a few questions left. So first, from Leo, who's joining us online, question that relates, if I quote, what would be your comment on the fact that people like Ismail Haniyeh live in Doha, while people in Gaza face war with Israel? I think if I can just broaden maybe the scope of that question, that relates to if you had to assess the sentiment. I mean, that's probably a difficult question, but if you had to assess the sentiment of the Palestinian population vis-a-vis Hamas, and we already discussed about Hamas motivations on October 7, but today, what would be your take on the way the war is impacting perceptions of Hamas among the Palestinians? Let's start with that question, and then we'll see if we have time for others.
It depends where. So I suspect that sentiment in Gaza would be pretty negative about Hamas because of the bombardment of the past 6 months. Now, Hamas is not responsible for the bombardment. Hamas doesn't have the bombs. Hamas isn't doing the targeting and so on, right? But I think a lot of Palestinians will quite rightly say, what on earth do you think was going to happen when you went into Israel? Did you not think that you were going to see a massive reprisal? And you took that decision and it doesn't seem to matter, or it didn't seem to matter what the consequences were going to be. You went ahead and made that decision. Actually, this is the critique that Fatah made very publicly, I think like 2 weeks ago, something like that. Because Hamas was criticizing the fact that Mahmoud Abbas had appointed a new prime minister. Said, you didn't consult us. And Fatah turned around and said, did you consult us when you went into Israel on October 7th? Did you consult us? And, you know, and the result of your decision led to a sequence of events that has resulted in a Nakba that's even greater than the one that befell our people in 47-48. Like, so there is definitely that sentiment that exists. Of course, it exists amongst Fatah. It's an old enemy of Hamas. But I think there's quite a lot of people, at least in the Gaza Strip, that probably share that opinion. We don't know how much. Okay, it's very difficult to do public opinion polls in such a situation in the best of times. Sorry, at such a horrible time. The situation in the West Bank, I suspect, is different. I don't know how different, but it is different. Because I think that there, a lot of people are very exasperated and frustrated by the Palestinian Authority. And this has always been the argument that has benefited Hamas. You guys went for the Oslo Accords and went for non-confrontation and negotiations and so on. The result has been that more and more territory has been taken away from you, that the West Bank has become like Swiss cheese. Settlements are popping up everywhere, and there is no prospect of any Palestinian state. whereas they at least did something, you know, they fought back. I say this in quotation marks, okay? But that I think is the sentiment among many people in the West Bank. But I think it also changes. I saw one poll, and again, I'm not sure how much value I put into these polls, but I think that sentiment was probably stronger at the beginning of the last 6 months. It's probably less so now, just seeing how much damage has been wrought as a result of the past 6 months.
I'm gonna merge two questions, which come from Zoom. Mm-hmm. One relates to the moves by Western countries to recognize Palestine as a state. Mm-hmm. Spain announced that it would do so by this summer. Now, how significant, in your view, is this move? And the other question is, I think, also related to the prospect for a Palestinian state. The question is, do you see October 7 in a way, I'm using the expression from the audience, as a nail in the coffin for the Palestinian state, given the devastation of Gaza and the constant land grabs in the West Bank? Or is it actually something that may accidentally or not lead to greater international pressure, greater international recognition for this Palestinian state? So two questions which I think are quite related. And these are the last ones, actually.
Okay. No, I just want to make sure I don't... that's hard. Fine. I'll try. Mm. Okay, so I'll be really frank. The declarations, I think, are useful for symbolic value, because it means that, you know, it becomes more of a consensus around the world that a Palestinian state is legitimate. And of course, in law, the case for that has already been established. It was established with the same strength in law as at least as much as a Jewish state in Palestine, because that all comes down to the original resolutions of 1947-1948. The problem is that without an enforcement mechanism, you don't actually see a reality change on the ground. But I think it is important politically, because politically, what we have right now is that these are the occupied Palestinian territories, and the occupying power is the state of Israel. That is the case as recognized by the United States, at least historically speaking, the United Nations, European Union, and I think pretty much the entirety of the world community, with the exception, of course, of the Israelis, who insist that Gaza is not an occupied territory. They claim it enjoys sui generis status, i.e. that it is unique in the world. So it's not unique. It's exactly the same as East Jerusalem, exactly the same as Golan Heights, exactly the same as the West Bank, and was exactly the same as the Sinai Peninsula. I.e. all territories that were occupied in 1967, and that all of these territories have to be withdrawn from. But if you recognize and you make a Palestinian state the basis of the discussion, then it's no longer these are the occupied Palestinian territories. It is that the state of Israel occupies the state of Palestine, in terms of, you know, Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Which, you know, politically speaking, is more difficult for the Israelis, but I don't think that they would change any policies in this regard. So the question then becomes, okay, why would they change any policies? And that again comes back to the United States. And would it help the case in the United States for there to be more recognition of a Palestinian state internationally? Probably. So indirectly, it could be quite helpful. But it would be indirectly. I think the fundamental, you know, thing that has to change with regards to addressing this historic conflict is actually not in the Palestinian arena or the Israeli arena. I think, frankly, it's in the American arena. And that in the American arena, there needs to be a recognition that the framing of this discussion that used to be the case at one point in the United States of it being an occupied territory has to be reinforced, but also that you are dealing with a political elite in your ally, okay, forget about Palestinians, in your ally that is increasingly being defined by the far right. It's a very uncomfortable thing to admit, but I think that that is the truth of the matter. And I think it makes the relationship between DC and the Israelis increasingly difficult over time. And I think the Israelis know that, and I think, frankly, that a lot of the Democratic Party knows that too. And irrespective, if I can say this, irrespective even of the occupation, this idea that Israel and the United States share values is going to increasingly come under challenge and tension, because again, if it's Ben-Gvir and Smotrich who become increasingly a more common embodiment of what Israel actually is, politically speaking, that's not what Americans want to think Israel is all about. And if they're confronted with that, regularly speaking, because it's reality on the ground and becomes reality on the ground, I think that creates a really uncomfortable dissonance for a lot of the American political elites. But it is happening. And I think that you see another trend happening at the same time, which is just the popularity for supporting Israel and not being more balanced between Israel and the Palestinians is diminishing within the American electorate, as you can see in public opinion polls that have been going on for years now, especially among Democrats. Less so among Republicans, but especially among Democrats and independents. And eventually that has an impact on policy, but it won't happen soon. But I think that that's actually where the real changes are likely to come from.
Thank you very much. So we have one last question.
What happens on November 5th?
Oh, Trump and Biden.
I don't know if the people on Zoom heard the question is, what if we have a change at the next election and Trump comes back?
Is that the question? Or
yeah, so who wins?
No. In relation to what you just said,
yeah.
What happens if Trump wins on November 5th?
Oh, I think the situation gets a lot worse if Trump wins on November 5th. But what I said about these trends are going on for a long time. So, and as I said, this will not change policy in the United States. In the short term, it will in the medium to long term, irrespective of what happens on November 5th. This is a completely separate discussion, but one of the reasons why the MAGA movement exists in the United States is that I think that there's a demographic in the American population that sees that the overall picture of the United States is changing and it freaks them out. And they're lashing out in very ugly ways as a result. But this trend is pretty undeniable. By the way, across American society, the Jewish community, the progressive sector, popularity for supporting Israel in this fashion just diminishes the more you go down in terms of age, and the more, I mean, the progressive argument, generally speaking, in American politics is becoming more and more popular as time goes on. And that's incompatible with a continuation of these policies with regards to Israel and the Palestinians.
On that note, thank you very much, Dr. Hellier. I think it's always good to know that things could actually get even worse. But thank you for this great conversation. My apologies for the people on Zoom that couldn't ask their questions due to the time constraint. We had to merge some of them, but it was, I can say, on behalf of the Institute, a true pleasure to have you back with us. You're always welcome. The door is literally open to you. We wish you all the best for the rest of your stay in Singapore and for the next adventures.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you to you. And thank you to the audience on Zoom as well as in the auditorium. Thank you all.